Next case is 99-818 Douglas Rutter versus Whirlpool Corporation.
That's never been the way we look at law of the case, counsel. Any later decisions don't change the law of this case. That's the nature of the doctrine.
Your Honor, I would typically agree with you if this case had come all the way, had come all the way through to maturity and had already been come to trial. But this is an unusual case procedurally because the case had not yet come to trial. The Oncology decision came down.
I realize exactly how it happened, but I think that law of the case, the doctrine of the law of the case, sets the law of the case. That can't stay open, and the fact that something now changes in U.S. constitutional law, that's not constitutional, statutory, interpretation of discrimination, the change in the status of the law doesn't change the doctrine of the law of this case. Even if it happens while the case is on its second round, one thing is set, and that's set early in the case. There was a decision, and it can't be changed even by a change in the law.
Your Honor, respectfully, I would disagree with that, in that, again, we have a situation here where the case is not yet was not yet set for trial. We asked the court to, we asked the trial court to reinstate the claim of sexual harassment based on what we believe was a significant change in the federal law applicable to the state law in this area.
And your contention is that you have under the rules of civil procedure, you have the right to amend your pleadings.
That's right. We can amend our pleadings and add back in the claim. In other words, have an amended claim based on the new law in this area.
And
your argument would not be the same if the case had gone through trial, gone to appeal, and didn't appeal, then we would be bound by the law of the case.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. Our focus is really on our ability to have amended the complaint after the Oncology case was decided and the case had yet to go to trial.
Was there a motion to amend the complaint? I only saw a motion to reinstate.
Your Honor, I think it was a motion to reinstate. I believe it was a motion to amend as well.
Either way, they were your complaint is that the denial thereof is, and I think we judge that even under law of the case, we can look at any error in the denial of that, but it's only in the abuse of discretion in denial of a motion.
Your Honor, I would agree that would be certainly a good way to look at that. That we focus on the refusal of the lower court to amend the complaint given the new law that had appeared.
Under abuse of discretion standard.
Under abuse of discretion.
Yes.
Mr. Fishman, you hopefully get a chance to make your argument at least at some point. I have a question, too. It seems to me as if the term sexual harassment and sexual discrimination are used somewhat interchangeably. When I read the amicus brief, I thought the issue was sexual discrimination. When I read your brief, it seemed to be sexual harassment. Can you help me clarify what, and a colleague helps a little, but can you help clarify what the issue is here? Is it sexual harassment or sexual discrimination? Does sexual harassment become sexual discrimination at some point? Is that how we look at it? Or?
Your Honor, Chief Justice, the origin of sexual harassment, well, this is a sexual harassment case from our perspective.
That's what I thought.
The origins of sexual harassment law are, in fact, in the sex discrimination law. But particularly based on Oncoli, that the doctrine of sexual harassment or the idea of sexual harassment has really grown beyond beyond the pure issue of sex discrimination. In other words, whether one's treated differently on account of his or her gender. In fact, Oncoli leads us to believe that sexual harassment can occur if it's on the basis of sex, which in our view means it could be on the basis of gender, certainly, could be rather than treating men differently than women, or it could be on the basis of the sexual nature of the harassment.
In which case it doesn't matter who's listening, it doesn't matter who the plaintiff may be, but it just, the language of the conduct is sort of directed at whoever happens to be in the way. That's not a very artful way to say it, but is that,
That's correct. The focus should be on the behavior, and that's borne out in both the Doe versus Belleville case, which is a pre-Oncoli federal court of appeal decision, and the Schmetting versus Tenemic Company case, which is a federal court decision after Oncoli, that clearly focuses on the behavior and not on the status of the parties, the sexual orientation of the gender of the parties.
Is discrimination with regard to sexual orientation, sexual harassment?
No, Your Honor, it is not sexual harassment. Discrimination on...
Why? It just seems to me it's discrimination, and we ought to put it all in one ball of wax.
Will you
do it on orientation or gender or what?
Well, Your Honor, I philosophically would agree that it should be included as sex discrimination as well. It should be all rolled up as one. But sexual orientation discrimination has been made clear in a line of federal cases and in a line of state cases that it is not considered to be sex discrimination. So if someone was harassed purely on the basis of their sexual orientation, for example, use of epithets referring to sexual orientation, calling them names, those kinds of things, without the sexual behavior component, that would be harassment on the basis of sexual orientation, and it's not currently prohibited under Ohio law.
The Court of Appeals focused on sexual orientation here.
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
And in addition to that, wasn't the activity, this objectionable activity, related to sexual orientation?
It was in part, Your Honor, but it was also sexual in nature, the meaning of sex toys, the mimicking of sexual activity, those kinds of things. So it may have been motivated by an animus towards sexual orientation, but it certainly was sexual in its nature. And I point out to you, Mr. Justice Douglas, that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Schmetting case, which I referred to earlier, makes that distinction that just because it is in part motivated by behavior, is in part motivated by animus towards one's sexual orientation, does not transform the case from a sexual harassment case to a sexual orientation case.
Why would you not argue that discrimination with regard to sexual orientation is also actionable? Do you have to somehow, to have a cause of action, convert this to a sexual harassment case?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular instance, I think we do, because the harassment involved was, in fact, sexual orientation, was, in fact, sexual harassment. The case law has been fairly clear for some time that until the state legislature puts the word sexual orientation into Chapter 4112 as a prohibited category of discrimination, that kind of discrimination is not good enough.
So that's what all those fights are about when you see them passing new legislation and they delete, as they did recently, sexual orientation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I see.
There's that distinction between the two. Although one might philosophically believe that it all should be rolled up into one, it unfortunately is not at this point. In the aftermath of the Ontali decision, it was certainly error for the lower courts to refuse to reinstate Mr. Redler's sexual harassment case, particularly given the similarity between the fact patterns of the Ontali case and the present case, given the broad consideration that Ontali gives to sexual harassment, and specifically given the legislative directive of 4112.08 to liberally construe our Ohio law against discrimination, as this court most recently recognized in its generic.
We have another factual question that seems to again bear on the definition here. The plaintiff here, I thought I read someplace that the plaintiff here was heterosexual. Is that correct, or do we know, or does it matter?
The plaintiff in this case, I believe, admitted in the record that he is a homosexual orientation.
Okay, I just read that.
Yes.
That's why the sexual orientation.
That's right. The court of appeals, that's right. And defense raised that issue, that this was discrimination based on his sexual orientation, was not therefore sexual harassment. We obviously disagree with that. And again, looking at the Schmetti case, the Eighth Circuit made that distinction. That is not a reason to transform the case from a sexual harassment case to a sexual orientation discrimination.
Why shouldn't somebody find that harassment with regard to sexual orientation is harassment?
Well, certainly that would be in my mind, that would be a reasonable ruling, Your Honor. There is some difficulty in that we have some case decisions that say it is not a prohibited form of discrimination. But again, I think
a federal court decision.
Federal court, it's
not
from federal court.
Not here.
I think if this court decided that we were going to say that harassment based on one's sexual orientation is, again, focusing on that, is harassment. That is prohibited activity, whether or not it's based on motivated by sexual orientation or motivated by one's gender or simply sexual in nature, I think that would be a reasonable conclusion that this court could make.
Then it wouldn't make any difference what we call it.
That wouldn't make any difference. We could call it all sexual harassment and it would be just fine.
Could you take this beyond that issue to whether or not there is a sustained cause of action in either case, regardless of what we call it, against the corporation? What did they do wrong, or what did they fail to affirm?
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Justice Piper-Dipp. The issue is that under the Karen versus Porter Payne case, the standard is whether the employer knew or should have known that the harassment was occurring. It is our belief that they either knew because there were supervisory employees involved in the harassment going on, or they certainly should have known, given that this was all occurring in the open workplace.
So if a supervisory employee is one step up from fellow workers on the line at Whirlpool, is engaged in conduct is charged to the employer per se?
Actually, Your Honor, yes, I believe it certainly it would be if there were supervisory employees involved. I'm not even sure, Your Honor, that it would require that there be supervisory employees. I think the standard for review and the factual review would be whether the employer knew or should have known that the harassment was occurring in that workplace. Yeah.
Those issues never got to the jury.
Those issues never got to the jury because the sexual harassment case was removed from the case. It's not dated. It's not dated.
But the, was that stressed out enough to, there wasn't summary judgment.
There was summary judgment, correct, Your Honor.
What were those issues fleshed out?
The issues were not fleshed out
for purposes of the
summary judgment. The issues were not, the issue of whether the employer knew or shouldn't have known of the behavior were not fleshed out in the summary judgment decision by the trial court initially. So we don't have a factual determination about whether that standard would apply in the case or not. Your Honor, quite frankly, for a long time, management was not apprised, the upper levels of management were not apprised in this case of the harassment going on. So in this particular case, we would rely on the should have known standard, not the absolutely acknowledged standard. Your Honor, for these reasons, we ask that this court remand the case back for trial on its merits on the sexual harassment claim and with Whirlpool as the employer as a defendant in the case.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Parsons.
May it please the court. A couple of points I'd like to address in my argument. First, Mr. Fishman, as he did in his briefs and as he did in argument, continues to argue that the fact pattern in this case is similar to the fact pattern in Ogali. And I'd like to address that briefly with the court because that is not the case. And I think the appellant has been somewhat reckless in representing to the court the discovery record and trial testimony. Unlike Ogali, and I think we should talk about the supervisors first, who were named defendants, Mr. Rollison and Mr. Moser. Unlike Ogali, Mr. Rutter acknowledged that he considered, that they considered him, Mr. Rutter, to be their friend. Unlike Ogali, these two gentlemen recommended that Mr. Rutter be promoted to a salary supervisory position. Unlike Ogali, on more than one occasion, they told Mr. Rutter that he was a good employee and that they appreciated how he made the monotony of the assembly line more enjoyable for his co-employees. And the backdrop of these incidents, I think the jury implicitly found by finding in favor of Mr. Rollinson and Mr. Mauser on the false imprisonment and assault and battery, they implicitly found that there was consent with respect to this little charade that they used to find. The record is replete that at Mr. Rutter's initiative, he would tell the folks on the second shift that we run out of parts. Everyone has to go home. And then they begin this play where they come in and they act like they were roughing him up. No sexual contact at all. He acknowledged in his deposition. And then he would then return to the line and say, yeah, I'm right. We are going to go home. And those were the two or three incidents that he described in 1987 and 1988. And there was only one other incident, which became the only actionable incident because of the statute of limitations with respect to the intentional torts alleged. And that was the incident of April 26, 1993. And that was for the first time when he protested and said stop, and they stopped. And later, Mr. Moser had gone to him and said, you know, I thought we were friends, and if you had a problem with that incident, you'd come to me. So that's what we have with the supervision, these three or four incidents, and again, all initiated by Mr. Rutter, which I think the jury found to be the case.
Is the employer
providing representation for the individual employees?
I represent both Whirlpool and the two individual supervisors.
Whirlpool has no responsibility. Why are you representing the individual employees? Are you being hired by them, or are you being hired by Whirlpool?
I was retained by Whirlpool to represent the two supervisors.
For something that Whirlpool has no responsibility for.
Whirlpool.
That seems a little strange to me, Counselor.
Whirlpool did take some action with respect to that last event, with respect to the two supervisors, the event of April 26, 1993. But they maintained that these earlier incidents were ones that were, if you will, good natured one.
Yeah, I understand about the record and understand after the letter came from the lawyer what they did. But it would seem if they are not culpable in any way, then they're extricated from the proceedings and they want to be done with it. But still, at least vicariously, they're in it through you, representing their employees.
Yes, that is true.
Well, that raises a legal issue. The administrative rules, I guess, adopted by the Civil Rights Commission, 41-12-505-J3, seem to give per se liability, seem to rather impose per se liability on an employer, whether it's sexual harassment engaged in by its supervisory employee. I don't know if you read it that way. It's not a statute, it's a rule, so it doesn't have the bearing of the statute, certainly, but it's written. It doesn't matter whether you knew or should have known, or the employer knew or should have known about it. If the supervisor engages in misconduct, the employer is liable. Pretty strict rule, I guess.
It is. And the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has suggested the same thing in the Fairbairn-Eller case. That's why supervisors should be treated differently than full employees. But my point is, whether you decide to follow the rule and say there's strict liability here when supervision is involved or not, the circumstances underlying the case here, exactly, and in any event, certainly would be severe or pervasive. I mean, this is over 5-6 years. And in that, the jury found was exactly as I described. I think that this court's going to have to conclude that the jury found with respect to deciding the contemptible force that, in fact, that this was a game, if you will. And then all of a sudden, in April of 1993, the rules changed.
Right.
And he protested, and they, the supervisors, honored his protest.
But I think the point that's being made is, if the harassment occurs, the rule promulgated, which I believe does have the, properly promulgated, has the full force and effect of law and statute, says the employer has responsibility. It's a per se statute, isn't it?
It is.
Per se rule. If that's the case, is remediation a defense?
It would seem to me, first of all, that is going to be the case. Remediation may not be a defense because we knew it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The knowledge imputed to the corporate knowledge imputed from its supervisors.
Which is what that rule says.
Exactly. But my point being is it was not unwelcome, first of all, which is required by the law.
Oh.
And secondly, if you find that somehow it was unwelcome, which I don't think this record reflects, that it wasn't severe or pervasive.
Okay, so your defense is not necessarily remediation, it's consent.
Consent and also...
If consent, if in fact it was harassment, and if it was, it was not pervasive.
Super pervasive is part of the law.
The council shouldn't be in the position of this state that harassment and or discrimination based on sexual orientation in the workplace is not action.
But that certainly, I agree with Mr. Christian, that's where we are now. That's discrimination based on sexual orientation is not acceptable.
Is that an appropriate posture?
I think that's a decision better made by the folks across the street and legislating whether that's appropriate. I don't think it's appropriate.
We have the common law responsibility as well. Is it appropriate for the common law of this state to be in that posture?
Oh, I agree. I mean, he tried his common law claims to a jury. The assault and battery, false imprisonment claims were tried to a jury. So, and Mr. Crispin was a great lawyer. I mean, we had an 8-count complaint originally. He had every theory that he could think of, as a good lawyer should. But if we're going to, I don't think we can legislate, though, here in this court against sexual orientation discrimination, whether it's good policy or not, someone else is going to debate it. And again, it's in the other form that I think that should occur.
Well, there is a legislation that says discrimination with regard to sexual orientation is not sexual harassment, is there?
No, it's not. But I think
so it wouldn't be legislated. It would be just recognizing that cause of action being an omnibus sort of thing, would it not?
Well, I think that would...
Legislative.
I think Justice Douglas, that would run afoul of your views, but I want to respond to that.
Counsel, how would that differ from the case in which we determined that sexual harassment in the workplace where you employ less than 5 people is a violation of law, not violence?
I'm not sure I follow your question, but
this court, I think, unanimously determined that we would not permit sexual harassment in the workplace where there are less than 5 employees. There is no statutory law setting forth that prohibition.
I think there's a
we determine it's just fundamentally wrong, and in keeping with the spirit of what else the General Assembly has done in the area
of I think there is a substantive difference between extending what the General Assembly has already done and quantify, if you will, the number of employees issue as it's more good versus ranging into an entirely new area which the legislature has not addressed. I think there's a substantive difference.
To answer your question, but to get a response to something like this.
I'm sorry. Oh, I was going to say you asked Chief Justice Moyer about the this confusion between sexual harassment and I refer to the word gender discrimination. But where we are in that is the Vincent Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decision said we're going to equate sexual harassment with gender discrimination. And on Colley, the Justice Scalia said the same thing, if I may. He said, Title VII does not prohibit all verbal or physical harassment in the workplace. It is directed only at discrimination because of sex. We have never held that workplace harassment, even harassment between men and women, is automatically discrimination because of sex, because the words used have sexual content or connotations. The critical issue, Title VII's text indicates, is whether members of one sex are exposed to disadvantages, terms, or conditions of employment to which members of the other sex are not exposed. That's the issue. And
well, that's the issue in a gender case.
And that's what they allege, and that's what Mr. Crispin still claims here. The sexual orientation...
What, that he was discriminated against because he was a man?
Yes, that's the only claim you can make to this court, because sexual orientation discrimination is not recognized in the state.
Well, but it was the activity that he complains of.
Yes.
It would have been the same activity had they been doing it to a woman. Would it not? I mean, I guess I'm not getting your distinction. I read what Scalia said, and it seemed to me he was talking about gender. And we're talking about the issue, first of all, same-sex sexual harassment. And they've already said, the U.S. Supreme Court has already said, that you can have same-sex sexual harassment.
Correct.
I mean, that it can't be condoned. It's prohibited. So
I thought he was saying, though, that the, on a gender thing, whenever you're trying to bring a gender case, you've got to show that the one gender is being treated differently than the other gender. But that's not what we're talking about here, are we?
That's exactly what we're talking about here.
Right.
That's exactly what we're talking about here. And on college stands for the proposition that same-sex harassment and therefore gender discrimination can exist. And they gave a couple examples, which I think are illustrative. One is, Scalia said, a trier of fact might reasonably find such discrimination, meaning gender discrimination. For example, if a female victim is harassed in such sex-specific and derogatory terms by another woman as to make it clear that the harasser is motivated by general hostility to the presence of women in the workplace. So again, it's gender discrimination. That's one of the examples that Justice Scalia specifically rolled out.
Try one more time. They were not saying that it is... They were not harassing on the basis that there was a man in the workplace. What Scalia's talking about there, I thought, was when you're talking about specific harassment because she was a woman in the workplace, as vis-a-vis a man. Here, they're just harassing the man, allegedly harassing the man, not because he's a man, but because of his sexual orientation.
I don't think, again, Justice Douglas, I don't think they're making that. I think they're arguing gender bias here because,
okay,
again, sexual orientation is not recognized. Scalia's example is, look, a woman can discriminate against a woman because she's a woman because she doesn't want more women in the workplace for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so his suggestion is that is gender bias, even though it maybe runs afoul of her own common sense that one woman would want to discriminate against another woman because of her gender being a woman. He said that can't happen. And that's what they suggested in Mancalli, that this man could be discriminated against by another man because of his gender.
Counsel, you don't feel that law of the case applies here?
I do.
You haven't argued it.
I know. I had one of the notes I wanted to make because Justice Cook raised it, and I do think the law of the case applies here. That Rutter won.
You feel he dropped the ball by not appealing at the beginning?
Yes, I agree.
And
you
that
don't
he's...
think it makes any difference the fact that he had not gone through a trial?
No, it does not.
It would apply.
I might point out, though, in Rutter 1 and Rutter 2, they based their decision based on, again, a finding that there was not showing gender bias sufficient enough to go to a jury. And that the finding that they did make was sexual orientation discrimination about which he complained. And the appellant repeatedly says, the appellant repeatedly states that this is our notion. This is what he testified in his deposition. I didn't put the words in his mouth. I asked him questions, and that's what he testified to.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Fishman, you've used your time. This may take 30 seconds.
I would just point out to the court that there are common law claims here that were not tried. There is a common law claim for sexual harassment under the Cameron's case that were not tried. And in reference to Mr. Justice Douglas's suggestions about including sexual orientation, as we do have the precedent here, and that this court has looked at public policy as an issue for wrongful discharge in the past, and certainly one could make the argument that it would be a violation of public policy to harass them on the basis of their sexual orientation.
You're talking now about a Greeley claim. I must admit, when I wrote Greeley, I never thought about that.
I will tell you, Honor, that those cases will be coming up to the next line at some point.
Well, that sounds like a threat, not a promise.
Your Honor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.